So yesterday we discussed two forms of Bloch's theorem. So what Bloch's theorem really tells us is that if you have a particle which is moving in a periodic potential, the wave function that describes the particle satisfies either this equation, or we can express the wave function in this form, where we have a plane wave factor multiplied by a function which has same periodicity as that of the underlying lattice. So far we have used this symbol k as a quantum number in these wave functions. So now let's discuss what this k really means. So this k, the quantum number, will be called quasi-momentum. So the reason it's called quasi-momentum is to stress that we really have electron moving in a crystal. So it is subjected to symmetries of the lattice that it is moving in and the boundary conditions. What we know is that this k is a vector in reciprocal space, because this k is Fourier transform of the real space. So now let's try to discuss this vector k in detail. So for the moment, let's consider a state that is where we have k shifted or translated by now a reciprocal lattice vector. So k is a vector in reciprocal space. Let's consider this state. Now, this state, we can use this form of Bloch's theorem. This state is also describing the particle in this periodic potential. So this, as a function of r plus capital R, must be equal to e to the power I k plus g dot r. So we've just applied Bloch's theorem to this state. Now, we know the definition of reciprocal lattice vectors. That is, e to the power I g dot r must be equal to 1. So this we can simplify, and we can just write it as e to the power I k dot r psi n k plus g r. Now compare this with what we have here. So by comparing these two, we can conclude that these two states have the same properties. The only difference is that the quasi-momentum k is translated in this state by a reciprocal lattice vector. So they obey the same properties. They must describe the same physical state. So in other words, if you know this state, you can add a reciprocal lattice vector to it, and you can calculate this state from it by just translating k by a reciprocal lattice vector, right? So why this is important is because this leads us to an important concept in condensed matter physics, which is called first Brillouin zone. So what we mean by that is, so let me just write it down. First Brillouin zone. So we'll call it FBZ. So first Prillwin zone is defined as the region in reciprocal space which is closer to the reciprocal lattice vector G equal to zero than any other reciprocal lattice vector. Right? So this is our definition that it's the region in K space or let's call it reciprocal space. Which is closer to the reciprocal lattice vector G equal to zero than any other G. So what does this really mean and why this is useful? Let's consider 2D squared lattice. Now, if you have 2D squared lattice, let's draw the points. And they continue in both directions. Let's write down the lattice vectors. So we can choose the primitive lattice vectors as, so A is the lattice constant. We'll choose the primitive lattice vector as ax hat, ay hat. This is our x-axis, this is y-axis. Now we know that we can obtain the primitive reciprocal lattice vectors from these direct lattice vectors by the definition. So the direct lattice vectors are given by in terms of these primitive lattice vectors. G is given in terms of primitive reciprocal lattice vectors. You can find out these Bs by the definition e to the power I g dot r equal to 1. We discussed that this corresponds to, there is a choice that we can make that bi dot aj, if we choose this, to be 2 pi delta ij. We can put this expression for G, that expression for R, use this. And from this, we can calculate. What we'll find is that B1 would be 2 pi over A x hat, and B2 is going to be 2 pi over A y hat. Now, this A is lattice constant. Typically, this lattice constant is going to be of the scale of angstrom. So 1 over A is usually a very large number, 10 to the power 9 or 10 to the power 10 meters, right? Now, if I'm going to draw it on the board, but it's on a different scale. So let me try to draw what this would mean. So I will choose G equal to zero somewhere. Let's say this is G equal to zero. Let's say this is G equal to zero. Then I will add N1, B1. I'm drawing it here. And then I'm drawing this is B1. Then so this is the reciprocal lattice. This I'm drawing in K space. And this is G equal to zero. So now let me refer to these numbers, M1 and M2. So this really corresponds to M1 equal to zero, zero. This corresponds to one, zero. This corresponds to zero, one, and so on. So these reciprocal lattice vectors, they span the entire reciprocal lattice. Now, what this first Prillwin zone is it is defined as the region in this reciprocal space which is closer to this g equal to 0 than any other vector. So what this means is the region, this region is closer than this, right? Closer to g equal to 0 than this vector. Similarly, you can see along this line, you will find that this region is closer. You can intersect. So basically, you divide this in half. This region, and you divide this in half. This region, then you divide this in half. This region, you divide this in half. Similarly, you do this. Divide this in half, this in half. So you would find that this region in K space is closer to G equal to 0 than any other point in K space, or then is closer to G equal to 0 as compared to any other reciprocal lattice vector. So this is what is called first Brillouin zone. Why is it useful? Basically, any point in reciprocal space, say Q, can be written as K plus G, where K belongs to first Brillouin zone and G is a reciprocal lattice vector. What means is any point far out here can be expressed in a way that you have some value of K in the first Brillouin zone and you have some reciprocal lattice vector. So for all Q in reciprocal space, there exists a K in first Brillouin zone and a reciprocal lattice vector G such that Q is equal to K plus G. This means that psi n q for any q can always be written as psi n. Now q can be written as k plus g. Now this k plus gr we discussed can be obtained from this by just a translation, right? So we don't even have to calculate any other eigenstates. We can just calculate all of the wave functions in the first labeled by K in the first Brillouin zone, and we are done. All other are related to these ones. So this helps us a lot that you just have to solve the problem in reciprocal space for just this finite set. Typically, we will plot eigenvalues that the that electrons can take, and we'll plot these eigenvalues as a function of k, and we'll restrict this plot to the first Brillouin zone. Any questions so far? So now let's move on to the another concept, which is called tight binding model. So this is a model to describe, this is our real space, to describe a lattice system, which says that electrons, which assumes that electrons are tightly bound to these lattice sites. So this is a good description, or this model is a good description, only if you have such a physical system. So this happens that some ions, say if the electrons are in s orbitals, which are tightly bound to the nuclei, this would be a good description. Or you can have some other system where electron, the wave function of electron is exponentially, say, decaying from the lattice site it is bound to. So if it is tightly bound to the lattice site, you can use this description. So the fundamental approximation in this model is that we assume that electrons can only live on these lattice sites. So before we discussed the general model of solid, we said electrons can be anywhere in between. Now we take an extreme limit where electrons can only be present on this, on these lattice sites. So how can we describe the dynamics, or what is left in the system that can happen? What is left can be described, or the dynamics of the system can be described by considering that electron can jump from one site to another site. So the way we will describe kinetic energy in this model is by these jumps. So this is called hopping. So one electron can hop from one site to another site. That's the only possibility, because electrons can only live on the lattice sites. So so in the tutorial today, you would solve tight binding model for honeycomb lattice, and you'll see that it gives rise to some interesting properties. So we can consider a very simple model and see what this, how this is really helpful. Let's consider now a 1D lattice. So if you have 1D lattice with equally spaced points, let's say the lattice constant is A. Now I can write down the Hamiltonian of this model, and I will write it down like this. Now, this is a tight binding Hamiltonian that I've written down. And let's look at these terms. This I, the sum over I and j, the sum over I and j in this term, and this sum over I, this is sum over all lattice sites. So what does the first, and these ci and ci dagger, these are operators that annihilate and create an electron on a given site, on the site which is labeled by index I or j. So the electrons can only be on these sites. You can choose this one to be site number 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. And for each site, you have a creation operator and you have annihilation operator. And this Hamiltonian can describe the dynamics of what is going on in the system. What does this term mean? This term means destroy an electron on site J, create one at site I. So this is describing hopping from site J to I. Similarly, this is describing hopping from site I to J. The strength of these hopping processes are described by minus Tij here and minus Tji. Minus we have just chosen for conventional reasons. So this term describes the hopping. This is equivalent to kinetic energy. What about this term? This term has Ci dagger Ci. So, and this Vi term, what this term means is you can think of this term as potential energy. So this is the energy cost that you have to pay, energy cost for putting an electron on site I. So this is sometimes also called self-energy of the site, which is the energy cost to put an electron on the site. Now, in our model, we are assuming that all sites are identical. That means this VI is really not, it does not depend on site I. Each site is identical. It's a Bravais lattice. So we can take VI. VI is basically a constant. It does not depend on site I. What that means is that this term is really equal to V. Let's call it V. V CI dagger CI. Now, CI dagger CI summed over all sites is simply going to give you total number of electrons. Right? Now, this NE, total number of electrons, need not be equal to total number of sites. Let's make another assumption about this lattice. Let's assume that at each lattice site, you only have a single quantum state. What that means is at each lattice site, you can at most have one electron. Now, if you have same number of electrons as the number of sites, there will be no site left to for hopping. All sites are filled, electron cannot hop anywhere. So electron can hop only if there are some empty sites. So in general, this number of electron is not going to be same as total number of sites. Another important thing is that in this model that I've written, any electron that is destroyed somewhere is created somewhere. So the total number of electrons is conserved. That means this NE is conserved. That means this whole quantity is just a constant. Right? So this whole term, this last term, is just a constant. And I can, from now on, I will ignore it. And how, why I can ignore it? I can simply, I'm interested in calculating the eigenvalues of energy. This is just a constant shift. So I can absorb this in by shifting the zero of, by redefining the zero of my energy eigenvalues. Any questions so far? So let's now look at this term, the first term. Now here we can, so let's ignore this from now on. Yes.
So if we have more sites than electrons, can we just have one term that says, okay, we have an empty site I, so we need to destroy something at J and create an I? We don't need the other one?
So we allow for all such possibilities, and they all will have some amplitudes. And this would really depend on what system you have, what type of lattice you have. Actually, it's a very good question. So one way to think of it is, imagine that electrons on this side, they have an exponentially decaying wave function. So in principle, any value of ij is allowed. That means you can hop from this point to some point very far away. In principle, that is allowed. But typically, these wave functions are going to decay very rapidly as you move away from the site. So people often make an assumption that they include hopping only to nearest neighbors. This is just an assumption. In principle, like what you're saying, any distant site, that hopping is allowed. In principle, long-range hopping is allowed. In most of the systems that we see, it turns out that the strength of this long-range hopping is quite small. So we usually ignore it, and we only allow hopping to nearest neighbors. In fact, this, you will see this symbol in the summation, and this symbol will specify that I and J, they are just nearest neighbors. So from going from here to here, let me put an approximation. I've assumed that long-range hopping can be ignored. So now this gives me CI dagger CJ plus TJI CJ dagger CI. and I've ignored the irrelevant shift. Now, an important constraint for the Hamiltonian is that it must be Hermitian. If we require that, so if we impose the constraint H is equal to H dagger, we'll find that this means that T I J should be equal to T J I star. And this would also mean that this must be a real number, which is also. So this is a constant shift we've ignored, but hermeticity guarantees that the potential is a real function, which it must be. Now, another approximation, not approximation, but another choice we will make is that we'll assume that Tij is real. Now, this is a choice. What that means is this choice corresponds to choosing a specific gauge for the problem. So if I have something complex here, I can choose a gauge in which I will redefine these operators and absorb that gauge in the operators. So choosing Tij to be real is equivalent to choosing a gauge. Because I'm only interested in eigenvalues of this Hamiltonian, I know that eigenvalues should not depend on choice of gauge. So we make our lives easy. We say that Tij is a real number. Moreover, because now we are only talking about nearest neighbors, we know that the site is the lattice, each site is identical to every other site. So hopping from this site to this site, or this site to this site, or say this site to this site should be same also. So Tij, because the system is translationally invariant, should also be a constant. So all these simplifications tell us that H should be simply equal to minus, let's say I call all of these hoppings as T. Now I sum over ij. This can be written as minus t sum over I ci dagger ci plus 1 plus its Hermitian conjugate. So what I've done here is I have sum over nearest neighbors only. So if I start from here, I have to write down all the terms. I would choose, I've just replaced j by I plus 1. For the boundary, you can think of this system as a closed system, impose periodic boundary conditions. So this side, you can impose periodic boundary conditions by saying that this hop has a probability T to hop here. It also has a probability T of hopping from here to the other end of the system. Now we are yes.
The creation and annihilation operators, are they creating particles at a particular position? So these are like the fields that we used last time.
So yes, so we'll go to Fourier transform and so, at the moment, this is in real space, so you're creating this particle on the site. So we can go to momentum space and talk about CK daggers. But you're right, this is creating at a specific point. Now we are going to have these factors of imaginary I, so let's label this as J. J plus 1. So now let's go to, so this is again a periodic system. These are creation and annihilation operators at fixed sites. and these sites are periodic, so it's very useful to go to Fourier's, to Fourier transform these operators and go to the reciprocal space. So we define the Fourier transform as Cj So this is the definition of Fourier transform. And now keep in mind, so you have seen in the, when we introduced the field operators, we discussed in the continuum. So you saw this definition or the Fourier transform with 1 over square root of volume integral over dx. 1 over volume integral over dx is now replaced by 1 over square root. 1 over square root of volume becomes 1 over square root of n integral over k is now sum over k, and x has been replaced by j times a. A is the lattice constant. Which means the distance between them. So typically you will have x here. This x, now we assume that can only take values j a. This is an approximation of our model. Now, putting this back in this Hamiltonian, we can see what we get. So our Hamiltonian, let's put J and J dagger, J plus one terms in it. This will be minus T over N, sum over J, sum over K, K prime, e to the power minus I, K, J, A, e to the power minus, oh sorry, plus, I, K prime, J plus one, C, K prime, C, K dagger, C, K prime. Now we can use this sum over j. We know the equivalent version in real space. Let me write it down in discrete space. So in this definition, what is n? This n is total number of sites. Now you have seen this formula in real space. You have 1 over volume integral over x, and this is x here. Now we have sum over j, x is replaced by ja. Volume is replaced by the total number of sites. So you doing this 1 over n, sum over j, this, we can see that the Hamiltonian, it simply becomes minus t, sum over k, e to the power ika, plus e to the power minus ika. Right? This, again, we can write this as minus 2t cosine ka ck dagger ck. Right? Now we discussed in the first few lectures that the one particle terms in the Hamiltonian, when they're written in second quantized notation, you have the number times some energy. So typically you will have one particle terms will look like this, sum over k, some energy as a function of k, ck dagger ck. For free particles, which means no potential at all, the particle is only has kinetic energy, we know for free particles, this energy as a function of k is simply h bar square k square over 2m. But now, energy as a function of k is cosine ka. So we can now plot this function, but what we discussed is that we only need to plot this in the first Brillouin zone, right? Now, first Brillouin zone for this lattice is very easy to calculate. So we have this 1D lattice. The direct lattice vectors are n1, a1. Let's choose this to be x-axis. a1 is simply a times x hat. E to the power I g dot r should be equal to 1. This implies that g should be m1, b1, and b1 should be simply 2 pi divided by a x hat. So the reciprocal lattice looks like this. Let's say this is g equal to 0. So when m1 is 1, that means this value, this is in now kx, or we'll call it just k. It's a one-dimensional problem. This is 2 pi over a. So let me just write the k values. This is k is 0. Let me write down the values of g. So this is g 0. This is 2 pi ax. And this will be minus 2 pi a. Minus 2 pi by a. Now, first Brillouin zone is the region in k space that is closer to g equal to 0 than any other. So it's simply this region. This line. This is the first Brillouin zone. What is the value here? It's pi over a. What is the value here? It's minus pi over a. So k belonging to first Brillouin zone, this simply means, this means that k is minus pi over a to pi over a. So now let me try to plot this. So I want to plot energy as a function of k for the tight binding model. I only want to plot in the first Brillouin zone. So I want to plot from minus pi by a to pi by a. So what is the value at k equal to 0? At k equal to 0, this value is simply minus 2t. So this, let's say, is minus 2t. What is the value at pi by a? At pi by a, we get plus 2t. And same value at minus 2t. So if you plot this, this looks like it doesn't look like cosine, but close enough. So it's minus 2t cosine ka. That's the dispersion relation we have. Note that this is different from what you would have guessed for, well, what we know is for free particles, you have parabolic dispersion, right? K squared by 2m. Another thing is, this is 2t. The bandwidth of this band is 4t. So if you measure experimentally the energy as a function of k, if you can deduce energy values that the system can take, you can do this by some experiments, like trying to inject electrons, see whether the system takes it or not. You can calculate with some specified momentum. So you can measure the dispersion relation. And if you experimentally measure it, you get a band like this. What you will get is 40. So in this model, you should really put T will be whatever is the bandwidth divided by 4. Any questions so far? So in the tutorial today, you will do something similar for two-dimensional problem, and you will find that you will get complicated combination of cosines. And close to some special points, you will have description of electrons that will be relativistic. So far we assumed we were working in a regime where the electrons are tightly bound. Now let's consider the opposite regime. So if electrons are tightly bound, we can use this tight binding model. This works. So I'm now talking about completely other, like, extreme, which is nearly free electrons. Typically, you will have systems that will be somewhere in between, which are, of course, harder to analyze. So we are just going to discuss these two extremes, and you can interpolate. So now let's talk about nearly free electrons. So the idea here is that the potential, the periodic potential that is created by the ions is very weak. So basically, we have electrons in a weak periodic potential. And what we would like to do is to use perturbation theory. So we'd like to use perturbation theory to solve this problem. So to do perturbation theory, first we should really discuss what the unperturbed states are and then move forward. So let's continue with the example of 1D tight binding, like just a 1D system. But now that is 1D tight binding model, right? Now I'm going to talk about 1D system, but nearly free electrons. So what I'm interested in is the same system, 1D lattice, but now the assumption is that electrons are nowhere tightly bound. They feel the potential of the ions only as a perturbation. Also, we'll impose periodic boundary conditions. So what periodic boundary conditions mean is if you have a lattice like this, it goes on and on, you can think of the first site is connected to the last site. So you can think of this as a system on a ring. This is site 1, 2, 3, 4, and then this is site 1. So what that means is site n plus 1 is actually same as site 1. Right? So if I use, so if I want to say talk about psi k at some site r, so now I'm using this psi k as a function of r, because now electrons can be anywhere on this, in this space. They're not forced to live on the sites. So I will have some wave function r. Let's see what happens if we add to it Na. So periodic boundary conditions tell us that because we have imposed periodic boundary conditions, this must be equal to psi k r. From Bloch's theorem, this n is an integer. That means this na is a direct lattice vector. So I can use the Bloch's theorem over there. The first version, this would mean that this is also equal to e to the power I k dot na. So from these two, it implies that e to the power I k dot na, this must be equal to 1. That implies that k dot a is 2 pi some integer n divided by n. So n is some integer. This implies that if you choose k to be some k times, let's say this is x-axis, this would mean that the values of k, they are 2 pi divided by na. What is n times a? That is also total length of the system. So you can also write this. These are many ways of writing same thing, which will be used repeatedly. So n times a is simply the total length of the system, or length of the 1D system. So another thing that we should discuss is, we said that the first Brillouin zone for the system, or for 1D system, is k belonging to minus pi over a to pi over a. So if you look at the, I'm missing an integer here, n. So this k, if you look at this extreme of the first Brillouin zone, that means that this integer must be minus n by 2. So this choice, first Brillouin zone, k between these two, is equivalent to saying that this small integer n goes from minus n by 2 to n by 2. So whenever you impose, so this is something that you would see routinely, when you impose periodic boundary conditions, or rather any boundary conditions, usually you will get quantized values of k, quantized value of momentum, and this is what we have simply seen here. So impose periodic boundary conditions that made that k, that made, that told us that k can only take some discrete set of values. You can also think of this as finite size. System essentially has finite length L, and so k must have discrete values that are these. If length is really infinite, you can think of it as continuum. Any questions so far? So now let's write down the equation that we want to solve. We want to solve the time-independent Schrödinger equation. So in writing the wave function now, I've explicitly included another quantum number p. So this is the equation that we are interested in solving, right? And we want to use perturbation theory. So this term, the second term, will treat as perturbation. Now, I have added another quantum number p for these wave functions, and this energy eigenvalue should depend on this quantum number also. I could have avoided it and could have said that K includes all of the quantum numbers, but I've just written it for convenience because it will be used later on. So nobody can stop me from writing other quantum numbers also. You could, but I just choose for convenience an additional quantum number labeled by P. K, we know we would restrict to the first Brillouin zone. Now, this potential U of X, we know is periodic. So this is what we want to treat as perturbation. So this is very weak, but it's still periodic. Because this is periodic, we can also use Bloch's theorem. And now we will use the second form up there. So Bloch's theorem applies to any periodic system. So I can write these eigenstates as e to the power I kx, now a function small u with labels p and k x, where this function u pkx must have the same periodicity as that of the underlying lattice. So here I've just used Bloch's theorem. Now what I will do, this is just a substitution. I will substitute this in this equation, and we can skip some trivial algebra. We can just see the result directly. What we will find is that if you plug in this form in this equation, you'll find that this, you will get minus h bar square over 2m minus k square u pkx. Now, we know that this small u function is periodic, and also the potential is periodic. So next trick we are going to use is, because we are dealing with periodic functions, let's go to the Fourier space. So we define, so it's useful to define Fourier transforms. So we are going to define Fourier transforms of the potential, which is capital U of X, as 1 over the length L, sum over q, e to the power I q x, u q, let's put tilde, this is just the notation for Fourier transform, and we'll define Fourier transform of small u, because that's also a periodic function, as u p k x, notice that I've chosen different normalization factors in the definition of Fourier transform. I did that just for convenience. This is just a convention. You could choose other also. Your results will have different, you will have just additional factors of L's or square root of L. But this is just convention to define. So we define these Fourier transforms. Now, what is left is, okay, let's try to put this all back in this equation. Now I'm not going to write down the whole thing. Now another thing is the q values here. They are 2 pi by a, times j, where j is some integer. These choice of q values ensure that capital U, these choice of q values ensure that these capital U and small u, they have same periodicity as that of the lattice. We'll prove this again later on using Bloch's theorem, that this must be the case. So after all the substitution, what you get is minus h bar square over 2m. You will get k plus q. Let me write down one more step. So you can see that this first term can be combined as minus, you can take minus outside, k plus q whole square. The second term and then we have the right-hand side. So this term simplifies a lot. You can just write this as q h bar square over 2m. K plus Q whole square times exponential and U. So we are going to, in this term, I'm going to say that Q double prime is Q prime plus Q, and then write it in a different way. So let me write down the result now. What I will find is this U tilde p k q plus 1 over l sum over q double prime, which I will replace with so q double prime . So I will be left with q double prime. Let's replace that q double prime by q prime. So if you play around with this, you will see that this is what you would get. So now we have an equation that says sum over q of this quantity must vanish. Now, this must vanish for every value of k and p. So what I've done in this term is I've chosen q double prime as q prime plus q, so I can replace the sum with sum over q and sum over q double prime. Sum over q, I've just put it here, and sum over q double prime would mean this will be e to the power I q double prime x, which could be relabeled. And then, so basically q prime will be q double prime minus q, and I've replaced q double prime by q prime. So go through the algebra, you will get this result. Let me double check to make sure. Yeah, so I see, so I will define this, and then I'll call q double prime q, and you can take that q outside, and then you'll have e to the power I q x factor from all over that cancels. So for this equation to be true, for the sum to be zero, for any value of k and p, what that demands is that each of this term is individually zero in the sum. So we get a new equation that says that this box quantity should be equal to zero for all q. Right? So now the next task is to do perturbation theory in U. So first we should find out what are the unperturbed solutions. So unperturbed solutions are obtained by setting. So now let's look at unperturbed solution. So the unperturbed solutions are obtained by setting u of x to zero. So if u of x is zero, the equation we want to solve for each q becomes rather simple. It's this. So we simply have this equation. So I will put these labels zero just to ensure that this is unperturbed solution. Now these unperturbed solutions, they have unperturbed energies, unperturbed wave functions. So one is the trivial solution. That would say, so this is how we should find them. One is the trivial solution that says all of the u zeros should be zero. So by the way, we want to do it for all q. So this trivial solution is not that interesting. This just means all the wave function of electrons is going to be zero. So we are interested in non-trivial solutions, which tell us that the unperturbed energy eigenvalues should be equal to h bar square over 2m k plus q square. Right? Now this is rather a strange equation. The left-hand side does not have q. The right-hand side does not have p. Right? What I also want is these u's to be non-zero. So if this is true, then we can have non-trivial solutions. So let's say this is true. That means u is no longer zero. But we want these u's to be normalized. So looking at this equation, we find it strange. So let's try to choose a form for U, and then we can verify if that works or not. So we are now guessing the solution, and we'll see what it works. So we are guessing, and we'll make the simplest possible guess. So let's say that U naught P K Q is delta P Q. The motivation for guessing this or trying this is just this side does not depend on Q, this side does not depend on P. If we put this U in the original, so this is our choice for, so we have made this choice in momentum space, by the way, right? We made this choice for in Q in the Fourier space. So delta function in Fourier space corresponds to constant in field space. So if I put this in my definition here, if I put a delta function of P and Q here, the sum over Q will disappear, and you'll pick up Q equal to P. So you'll simply get UPKX is e to the power IPX divided by square root of L. So it's rather simple. Simple form. So what this choice of U does is you find out that the zeroth order wave functions now in real space should be equal to 1 over square root of L e to the power I dx. Right? Just put this in the definition of Fourier transform. Now we can write the think about the full wave function psi pkx. This is 1 over square root of L e to the power I k plus p times x. Right? Now again, we know, or it's Bloch's theorem tells us that this must obey those properties, this wave function. So we can impose this constraint that psi pk x plus a, this should be equal to psi pk x. Now, what is psi pk x plus a? This, we can use Bloch's theorem. The first form, this is simply, this should be equal to e to the power I k a times psi p a. Okay, I think I should just write. So let me start with using Bloch's theorem. So this should be equal to e to the power I k times x psi p k x. Let me see if that is that correct from the Bloch equation? Oh yeah, sorry. IKA this. Let's compare this with this. So basically, we see that this is x plus a, which can be written like this. This is x. We also know that if you use the second form now of the Bloch's function, Bloch's theorem now. The second form tells you that these eigenstates, can also be written as a plane wave factor times a U, which should itself be periodic. So if I look at this form is 1 over square root of L, e to the power ikx times e to the power ipx, right? So from the second form, that means that e to the power ipx divided by square root of L, this should be a periodic function. This should have same periodicity as that of the lattice. Right? This implies that e to the power I p x plus a should be same as e to the power I p x. This implies e to the power I p times a should be equal to 1. So now we can see that p must take values which are 2 pi over a times n, where n is some integer. Right? So this p, you can also think of, it's also a vector in reciprocal space. So it's also, you can think of this as a quasi-momentum. But for the moment, we have not restricted it to the first Pillman zone. So we are going to discuss this now. We expect these wave functions to be normalized. So let's take two wave functions and see what normalization condition gives us. So we are talking about p, k, x, star, and p prime, k prime, x. And we are talking about the, so in the above analysis, you can also think of them as, let's assume that they were done for unperturbed wave functions. So we expect these wave functions to be normalized. What does this give us? Let's put those forms. This gives us, you will get the total length factor, and then you will get two plane waves. So this will give you a delta function, k plus p, comma k prime plus p prime. Right? Now, this is not how normalization conditions look like, right? Typically, you would see delta kk prime, delta pp prime. So actually, it is the same thing, but it's to see that we have to do a bit of work. Let's assume it's okay. Now we know that k belongs to the first Pillman zone. Let me draw the first Pillman zone. This is 0. This is plus pi over a. This is minus pi over a. So we know that k belongs to first Pillman zone. And p is simply 2 pi over a n. Let's start with the case that p is 0. If p is 0, so p can either be 0 or it can be plus 2 pi by a, minus 2 pi by a, 4 pi by a, minus 4 pi by a, and so on. These restrictions are obtained by imposing Bloch's theorem again. P can only take these values. So 0 is allowed. If p is 0, then this delta function gives us that k should be equal to k prime plus p prime. Or let's write it rather this, k prime is equal to k minus p prime. And now we restrict K prime. Yes.
I'm completely lost. You are in 1D and you don't have internal quantum numbers. So why does your wave function has two quantum numbers?
So these are these quantum numbers. They are coming from the lattice symmetry. So we have this discrete symmetry, right? So does that so there's still some symmetry in the. Does that answer your question?
No.
So I would say these are not intrinsic quantum numbers. These are quantum numbers that are coming from the underlying lattice. So we should not associate. So if I take away the periodic potential, these quantum numbers are not there. Or these quantum numbers will be zero. So all of them are there only because you have discrete. Only you have a lattice potential. In other words, let's put it this way. If there cannot be any quantum number, I should find out that it would be zero and would be irrelevant.
You mean if you set u to zero, you should set quantum number to zero?
Yeah, so I would find these quantum numbers to be redundant. Let's say I agree with you, and if that is the case, I will find that these quantum numbers should be redundant, and I will discuss a case where it will hint. So what you've said is correct. We'll, in the end of the class, I will show you why we still kept it, because the next step that we are going to do will require this P that we'll discuss tomorrow. But let's say it's a good observation, and in the end of the class, it will become clear why I went through this whole trouble of introducing something which might be redundant. So if P is zero, K prime can be written this. If K prime is restricted in the first Brillouin zone also, the lowest value of, and say P prime is not zero. So if now, say, K prime also belongs to first Brillouin zone. And that means if P prime is not equal to zero, then K prime cannot belong to the first Brillouin zone. So if we require K prime to be in the first Brillouin zone, the only possibility is P prime must be zero. Why? So K prime should be restricted to these values. K is in these values. If P prime is not zero, then you really have to add 2 pi by a here. So you will maximum, if you start from this edge and you add 2 pi over a, you will already be at this edge. Or you subtract 2 pi by a, you will already be at this edge. If you're here and you add or subtract p, you'll already be at this edge. So think about this at home. You can prove that if k and k prime belong to the first Brillouin zone, then p and p is zero, then p prime must be zero. That means if k and k prime are in the first Brillouin zone, you can write this as delta kk prime, delta pp prime, where pp prime, if they are zero, then it must be the case. Now imagine if p is not zero. If p is not zero, it's again a value 2 pi by a, which is much larger than this. It's some value here. If k and k prime are in first Brillouin zone, the only possibility we can have is that both p and p prime must be outside the first Brillouin zone. So this analysis tells us that this can be written as delta kk prime, delta pp prime. So again, it looks like it really behaves like a quantum number, right? But still, I have not answered your question, why is this relevant at all? But so far, our construction, we have constructed the solution in a way that it behaves. So this normalization condition, it behaves like an independent quantum number, which labels the states. So I can also provide an answer to you just in 5 minutes, it would be clear. This P, this additional quantum number, this would later become what is called band index. So it really is, we'll see this in future. And right now we've just introduced it for convenience. So now we are almost there. Let me answer your question. So we know that EP0K, this is h bar square over 2m k plus p square. If I choose p equal to 0, I have h bar square k square over 2m. If I have p equal to minus 2 pi by a, and so on. So let's try to plot this. So now I'm interested in plotting these unperturbed solutions, the energy values E. E naught EPK as a function of K, and I'm going to plot it from pi by a, from minus pi by a to pi by a. So let's. So on. So these units I will choose as h bar square pi square over 2ma square. Let's plot the first one, which is p equal to 0. P equal to 0, 1, hk square over 2m. This will look like this. So this is the branch with p equal to 0. If I plot this one, k minus 2 pi, so this is really a function that is obtained by shifting this by 2 pi over a over here. So within the first Brillouin zone, this function will start from here, and it will go till 4. So at 0, the value is going to be 4 times h bar square pi square over 2ma square. This is 9 h bar square pi square over 2ma square. So at this value, I'm really going to get here. So this function, it will look like so this is p equal to 0. This is p equal to 0. This is p equal to minus 2 pi by a. Similarly, if I plot p equal to 2 pi by a, it's going to be like this. So this is the curve for p equal to plus 2 pi by a. Now let me address your question. So you rightly mentioned that why we have done this. Isn't this redundant? The reason is that we have, so far, we are looking at unperturbed solutions. So even though I tell you that the underlying lattice is responsible for P, for perturbation theory, there is no potential, right? In that case, what you said must hold true. P should be a redundant quantum number. And in fact, it is. Let's see how. So I'm going to draw it here. It might not match completely over there. Use your creativity. So assume that we don't have any potential. That's unperturbed energy levels. So what you expect is the dispersion should simply be parabolic. So we are going to assume that the dispersion, it is like this here. Always difficult. Let's say like this. And if you don't have don't restrict it to the first Brillouin zone, it will keep going on and on. Let's see what we are really doing. Let's keep this. So this is now energies. Let's say I omit P here because, can you see the, yeah. So this is the unperturbed energy levels. Can you see this level? I've just removed the label P because we expect this to be redundant. In fact, in this picture, you can obtain this picture by simply restricting K values to the first Brillouin zone. How? At this point, this is called the zone folding. At this point, fold, we want to represent all of the K values within the first Brillouin zone. So all these points, you will bring them back to the first Brillouin zone by adding or subtracting a reciprocal lattice vector, which is equivalent to inverting this about this line. Same here, I will invert around this line. Now, I again get something here. I will invert along this line. And then I will invert along this line. And now I will keep doing this, and I will have a representation in the first Brillouin zone. So what I've obtained there can also be obtained just like this. So you will see this value is same as this value here. So these curves are going to be identical. So if we are only interested in, if we don't have periodic potential, you're absolutely right. We can just, if we just restrict momentum to first Brillouin zone, this is what we are going to get. The reason we keep this P is when we add perturbations. So this is unperturbed solution of our problem. What you should really compare these two solutions with is the other extreme of tight binding model that was done over there. When we are going to include potential, we'll look at this picture and we'll see that at these points, there is degeneracy. And that would lead us to we must use degenerate perturbation theory, and we'll see that what perturbation does is it opens up a gap at these points. So then it opens up a gap here, it opens up a gap here, then what you would get in the end is something here, which is separated from something here, then something here, gaps in between, and then this P becomes useful because it emerges as band index. You have one band here, one band here, one band here, and so on. So to do this, we have to include perturbations. Now, we don't have time for it. We'll do it tomorrow. And this will not only lead us to various bands, but we'll also discuss that this will help us in proving a fundamental theorem in condensed matter system, which says that one-dimensional lattice is unstable at a special point, which is if it is filled with exactly half the number of electrons than the number of sites. So we can prove this theorem using our result for perturbation theory. Any questions? Okay, so let's end here today.